Right, so there will be some paradoxes. But before that, let me give you an outline. So first I'll give a little bit of a discussion on a quantum computing inspired way of thinking about the quantum to classical boundary. Then I'll discuss some quantum paradoxes and whether the Bohmian picture can give us anything interesting there. In particular, the interesting connection between Bohm de Broglie and Wigner distributions. And then I'll conclude by a little bit of a discussion about the role of position in quantum theory. So first things first, our quantum world and why it looks so darn classical. So if you open a quantum mechanics textbook and if it gets the question of why the world is classical, it often will say that it appears classical because of so-called decoherence. And the way to understand this is by drawing this very simple schematic. You have some kind of system, which we're calling the quantum system. There's an apparatus, and then there's the environment. The apparatus is good, the environment is bad, and there's some kind of coupling rate, GA to the apparatus and GE to the environment. And what I will discuss from now on, we'll focus on one quantity, which is essentially the ratio of the coupling of your system to the apparatus over its total coupling to everything in the universe. And in quantum computing terms, this is nothing but 1 minus the error rate you would experience in trying to control your system. So I'm not trying to present a sort of a very philosophical point of view, just a very practical one. In what situations can you think of a system as classical without any reference to what classical means on a foundational level? So essentially what this quantity means is how much of the information available about the system, whether to the experimenter or to the universe, is actually in the hands of the experimenter. That's what this quantity means. And if you take this very philosophically seriously, you become a quantum Bayesian, which I am not, so I do not take this too seriously. Okay, so now suppose you want to build a bona fide quantum computer. And you basically just take my little simple cartoon model and you extend it very, very slightly. You now have n particles. And they still have some coupling to the environment, which is bad, some coupling to your apparatus, which is good, and then you also have some kind of internal couplings, which may be good or bad, depending on certain conditions that I will get to. And to build a good quantum computer, you only need two things. You need to have many particles, so n is large, and you need the behavior to be controllable and unitary. So this parameter epsilon has to be very small. So in the best realizations we have right now, and these are very order of magnitude, so apologies to people who are very care about the 9 times whatever. The error rate can be as low as about 10 to the minus 4. So that means that the experimenter controls 99.99% of the system. And then you can have up to 10 particles, or maybe 100. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter because that's not what I'm discussing here. So if you're a person who believes in spontaneous collapse theories, you will say that you can't really build a quantum computer of arbitrary size. Because eventually, once n becomes large enough, you'll have enough collapses happening that are not inside of this model I'm describing here that your computer will fail. So for large enough n over epsilon, your computer doesn't work anymore. And so another crucial parameter is the maximum coherence time of your quantum computer, or just quantum system in general. It's essentially 1 over the total coupling rate to the environment. Once the system has leaked half of its information to the environment, it can no longer be coherent. It doesn't display interference effects. And it's very important to note that this coupling to the environment can actually include internal degrees of freedom. The environment does not have to be outside of the system under consideration in order to be able to steal information about it and hide it from you as the observer. So if you read literature about trying to build a quantum computer, there's some trends that come up. Every system that people use for implementing quantum experiments shares several features. So here are just some examples. So for example, photons are very popular. And you can do all sorts of things. You can take the spatial mode as your quantum system, its frequency, its polarization, the number of photons. You can have atom-like systems, so actual atoms or other things. And there, typically, the degree of freedom you have is what you would call as a spin. And of course, you can also study the motional states of mechanical objects, such as mechanical oscillators, BECs, so on and so forth. And if you look at the list long enough and squint at it, they have several features in common. In particular, you as the experimenter are able to initialize the system into an effectively zero temperature state. And in addition, the things that you would describe as the controls, so the things I called the apparatus in the previous diagram, essentially also have zero temperature, which means that they do not introduce any uncontrolled information into the quantum computer or quantum system you're trying to control. And in addition, these particular degrees of freedom, the reason why they're used is they're very well decoupled from other degrees of freedom. Essentially, GE is very small for these ones, and that's why they're so popular, because you can actually do something with them. So as everyone's favorite example of a quantum system, I could not resist to discuss Schrodinger's cat, but for ethical reasons, I will be discussing Schrodinger's spherical cat. So instead of using a cat, let's just use a featureless blue sphere. And in particular, the blue sphere doesn't have any properties except for its position. So this is to avoid having to discuss what's actually happening inside the cat. And the cat state, so-called, will be a spatial superposition by 10 to the minus 15 meters, so the diameter of a nucleus. And the only other feature that this sphere has is that it has a mass equivalent to a cat, so about 10 to the 26 particles. So even if you build a perfect box that is entirely opaque, information about your spherical cat will still escape to the environment. And it can happen through the most bizarre and things that you would normally neglect mechanisms. So for example, if this spherical cat is inside of a black box orbiting the Earth, due to the sun, there's a certain flux of neutrinos going through your cat. And even though neutrinos interact very weakly with matter, there will still be one scattering event off your cat every million seconds. So that's already a limit on how long your cat can be in a superposition of dead and alive, or left and right, as I'm drawing it here. More strong couplings, which you could think about how to shield, but probably is not possible, would be a gravitational interaction. The fact that there's a spatial superposition of two states means that there is an energy difference between the two states of the cat, and those coupled to the Earth's position, because it's sort of in orbit. But the Earth's position is not protected from the rest of the universe. The universe is coupled to the Earth very strongly. It's not inside of a black box. And that means that this quantum superposition will dephase or decohere, or whatever you want to call it, in a time which here is about 10 to the minus 17 seconds. And of course, there's black body radiation, which you could suppress by making your cat very cold. So for a real cat, these things don't matter at all. The only thing that matters for a real cat, the reason why you cannot make an actual Schrodinger's cat, is the fact that the cat's own internal state will act as a very effective reservoir, a place where any information that existed as a quantum superposition has now vanished into. And the typical kind of parameter values is basically the number of particles times some typical coupling frequency of a particle to other particles, and so it's something very huge. So the cat basically has no chance. And of course, if you talk about Schrodinger's cat and about how things decohere, someone will be like, well, you know, that's all irrelevant, because in principle, if you could control all the degrees of freedom and all the information coming out of the cat, you could just grab the cat and then apply the Hamiltonian and make the unitary reverse itself, and then voila, you have a superposition. So people who work in quantum computing have already figured out this problem, and it's called fault-tolerant quantum computation. Basically, as information about your system leaves it, can you still continue to perform a coherent operation? And the answer, the very fact that it's possible at all, that there is a finite threshold, is very interesting. But typically, if your quantum computer has an error rate of more than about 10 to the minus 4 per gate, you cannot do this. So in order to keep the coherence of your cat, you would need to monitor it with a quantum computing with a power that's 10,000 times more than these internal decoherence processes. And so in order to do this, you would need to apply a lot of energy to the cat. And Yakir actually referred to this yesterday when he said that if you really want to make a Schrodinger's cat, you would need to apply an impractical amount of energy to it. And in this case, your cat would heat by a very large number of degrees per second and would no longer be a cat. So this is why you really can't build a Schrodinger's cat. All right, so to wrap up this section, classical systems, what makes a system classical is a strong coupling to a thermal environment. And so you can use both internal and external degrees of freedom, and typically these coupling strings are very large. But the interesting thing, and I think is sort of a very maybe key feature of classical systems, is that each other thing that they're coupled to only carries a very small fraction of the total information about the system itself. So there's a huge amount of information about the system that's being transferred somewhere else, but each other observer only controls a very small fraction of it. And I think that's essential to things being classical. On the other hand, things that we would call quantum are essentially zero temperature and are coupled to other things that are zero temperature. So there's nowhere for the information to hide. And of course, the challenge for building quantum computers is that things that we can control easily tend to be degrees of freedom that the environment couples to well. And so there's kind of a trade-off between something we can control and something that the environment will decohere for us. So in this very simple doodle, to go from a quantum system to a classical one, the most important parameter is what fraction of the information you have as the experimenter. So that's the end of the first part of my talk. Now I will tell you about what happens when David Bohm and Eugene Wigner go out for lunch. So here's a simple quantum system that we all know and love, maybe slightly different. So this is a quantum harmonic oscillator with some non-classical initial state. The fact that it's non-classical is not very important, but it will be more entertaining this way. So let's see. Come on. I'm trying to make this play. Here we go. All right, so this is the time evolution of the wave function inside of this harmonic oscillator. Red and blue are the real imaginary parts. That's not essential. The essential thing is that you can then plot the probability density, and over time it will evolve in this funky way. So things go back and forth, and there's some interference. So this is a very quantum mechanical perspective. What if you want to ascribe, say, realism or elements of reality that correspond to this situation? Well, if you're David Bohm, you're going to say, well, there is a real position, it's a hidden variable, and it will evolve together with a wave function guided by a certain quantum potential, and there's a very nice equation that makes sure that the distribution follows Born's rule, but this position really exists. And so then you can draw this kind of picture of the Bohmian trajectories, and all is good and well. But if you're Eugene Wigner, you're like, well, we don't have to do that, we can just do everything in phase space. And if you plot the Wigner function versus time, it will also evolve. And for a harmonic oscillator, as you all know, it evolves in a particularly simple way. And then when you go to observe a property of this quantum system, such as a quadrature, so the position or the momentum is just described by a projection of the Wigner function onto the relevant degree of freedom. And so there's a very interesting connection between these two things. So let's just take a picture of the Wigner function at some particular arbitrary time. And we focus our attention on a certain position of the particle in this phase space. Then we take a cross-section through momentum, and this is the probability of finding a momentum conditioned on the particle having this position within phase space. So, of course, this can have negative values, but never mind that. We can define what would be very simply called the Wigner velocity, which is you just take the expectation value of the momentum of the particle conditioned on its position being at a given point. A very intuitive idea. And of course, David Bohm says, well, I already defined a velocity. What's wrong with my velocity? And it turns out that they're actually exactly equal. It's a relatively straightforward calculation with a few integrals. So the ontological difference between Bohm and Wigner, basically Bohm says, well, the position coordinate of the particle is what's real. It has special significance within our theory. And the momentum, the distribution of momentum given a certain position, is what is absorbing the quantumness, or kind of is taking up the bizarreness of the situation. So you squinted this long enough. Oh yeah, also I have to point out that this is just the kind of, it's not rendering at all. But in Ephraim's talk, he discussed making measurements of these kinds of momentum distributions, and that's very similar, where you get negativity through a weak measurement. A negative probability value by using weak measurement. Okay, so if you squint at the previous slide long enough, you realize that why does position have to be special? And it turns out it doesn't. So you can define a Bohm-like theory by essentially transforming from x and p into some other coordinate system. So you define x theta and p theta, which are just pointing along some other direction, and they're perpendicular to each other. And now I'm going to call x theta my hidden position, and p theta is going to be the conjugate variable that's taking up the quantumness. And so you think this might be crazy, but it's actually not so crazy. It's pretty simple to understand what this kind of continuous rotation in phase space might mean. So for example, if you work with large ensembles of spin 1/2 particles, you can live in a very large block sphere. And then if you live in a very small region of it, that kind of looks like position momentum, you can actually do a rotation which continuously transforms two conjugate variables into each other. So that's not a problem. Or if you were at Gus Lobo's talk yesterday, it turns out that this is exactly equivalent to a fractional Fourier transform, because we know the momentum is just the regular Fourier transform of position, and a continuous version of that generates exactly this kind of transformation. So then, let's plot Bohmian trajectories for different values of this theta. So this is for the same situation I showed earlier, and this is just in regular space. This is what you saw before. And so now we rotate by pi over 4, pi over 2, et cetera, et cetera. And this is momentum space here. And then you will look at this and you'll be like, well, Boris, this is not very interesting. They all look exactly the same. And it turns out to be a very special feature that I'll get to in about 5 slides. But the reason that they're all the same is essentially that we're inside of a harmonic oscillator and the Hamiltonian is very special. So let's just look at a slightly more interesting case. So now I have still an approximately harmonic oscillator, so the dynamics are somewhat understandable to our harmonic oscillator biased minds, but I add a little bit of a bump here. It's kind of an ugly harmonic oscillator. So let's see what the evolution looks like. First, if you're Schrodinger, now things kind of still oscillate and go back and forth, and there's like ripples and things. And if you're Wigner, now you start with a beautiful initial state, and as you go along, it gets distorted in terrible and painful ways. And of course, the quantumness are these negative regions, which are blue. And of course, from this, now you can pretty easily calculate what the Bohm-like trajectories would be. And so you see here that now they actually depend on the value of theta that you chose. So now there is a real ontological significance to choosing a different quadrature as what is physically real in your Bohm-like theory. So why should we choose the regular position over some other position? Well, if you read our friend Howard Wiseman's paper in 2007, you can actually define what he called a naive velocity, which you essentially get from a weak measurement of position, of momentum, conditional position, and it turns out to be exactly mathematically equal to what I was calling earlier as the Wigner velocity. But then, of course, if you have a Hamiltonian, which looks like a normal, well-behaved Hamiltonian, the thing that you measure, which is this, the evolution of this x theta, which is equal to the naive velocity, is equal to what you want only if you choose position as your hidden variable, or, as that's what you saw earlier, if the potential is a harmonic oscillator. And actually, you can transform to this form of the potential by appropriately scaling the position, and so any quadratic potential is in fact allowed. So to summarize this section, you can generate as many hidden variable theories as you like. Bohm de Broglie tells you that position is the hidden variable. That's not strictly necessary, but it's still very nice. All right, so as I promised, there will be paradoxes. So the first paradox I want to discuss is the surrealistic Bohm trajectories, which essentially consists of the idea that you can have, in Bohmian theory, a detector click, even though a position measuring detector click, even though the Bohmian trajectory did not pass through it. And this is also known as the empty wave problem. And people have argued that this is bollocks because they dispute the analysis using spin and how you treat spin in Bohmian mechanics, but actually spin is irrelevant. And Aharonov and Weidman pointed this out already 20 years ago, and I just want to show you a nice calculation of this analysis and how it looks like in pictures. So it's possible to formulate the problem entirely in terms of position momentum variables, where Bohmian mechanics claims to have a very single-valued, clear picture of what's going on. So here's what we do. We have a double slit experiment in coordinate x1, and then we have a momentum pointer that will couple to these two slits. And basically, if x1 passes through this slit here, you get a very slight kick one direction on x2. And if it passes through the other slit, you get a very slight kick to the left. But the point is that these kicks are large enough that if you wait for a while, you will deterministically know which slit the particle passed through. So the uncertainty of the momentum is less than the magnitude of the momentum kick, which I just mathematically described here. So if you understand this, then what I show you here will be very clear. So this is the system coordinate, x1, and this is the pointer coordinate, x2. And you notice that the pointer initially, its position is the same for both slits, but the system has this double slit feature. We play the movie, and you see here that something interesting is happening in the intervening time. Even though at the end of the experiment, the blobs corresponding to the left and right slit have fully separated, and so by detecting the position x2, you know exactly which slit the particle went through, x1. Nonetheless, in the intervening time, there were some two-particle interference fringes, and this is what generates these surrealistic trajectories. So now I show you the same thing, except these blue dots are some Bohmian trajectories, and these black dots are some other Bohmian trajectories starting in the left and right slits, respectively. And then you play the video, and watch carefully what happens to, say, this guy in the corner. Sorry. So things collide, and then it's starting to get stripped off and being carried away by the wrong wave packet. So what this is telling you is that if you detect x2 here and x1 here, what this means that the Bohmian trajectory really did pass through the left slit, but you detected a click in the detector corresponding to the right slit. So here's just some more pictures so you can see it without having to remember what a video looks like. And the key takeaway is that same thing happens. So surrealistic trajectories are real. And what this means is that even if you have a perfect detector of position, which is the preferred coordinate in the theory, you can still have a misfire, which means that in particular, it misfires depending on the measurement context. So that's the connection of contextuality. And so only classical detectors will reveal the true hidden value of the position. OK, so one more paradox, because I couldn't resist. So Hardy's paradox, you all know it. Basically, it corresponds to having two interaction-free measurement setups that are put together. You have an electron here, a positron here, and then here they will explode. And if they don't interact, then the particles will always be detected in the bright detectors, B1 and B2. But of course, when you allow this interaction, sometimes you'll have detections in D1 and D2. So both dark ports clicked. And if you interpret each interferometer on its own, when the dark port clicks, that means that something blocked this path. And that means that the other particle must have been there. So if both of these click, naively you would interpret that both the electron and the positron pass through the interaction region, which of course is impossible. Oh yeah, and this is kind of the time interval for the simulation, so I'll show you. So first, let's do it without the interaction and explosion. This is what I call Hardy's interferometer. It's just two interferometers operating separately. So wave packets come in, they hang out in the middle, and then all of them come out in one part. And this corresponds to basically the bright ports clicking 100% of the time. Now we do this with trajectories, and there should be nothing surprising here. They come together, and then they agglomerate, and then they do a little bit of a tunneling dance through these fringes, and then they all leave together. So nothing special. Nothing to write home about. Now here's the real reason why I show this. So I could use this little PowerPoint boom thing, which I haven't used in many years. So let's see what happens now if we do have the electron and the positron destroy each other when they're in this negative-negative port of the interferometer. So this is without the trajectories. So things come in, but now you no longer have this guy. And without this guy, something different happens. The yellow is always hard to see. This projector is pretty good. If you squint hard enough, you'll convince yourself that there's a 1/16th probability of the both dark ports clicking. As you see, it's very small. So this is my last video. So with the trajectories, now you see that a few of these stragglers will actually reflect off and go into the cloud corresponding to the dark ports clicking. So how do we interpret this? Basically, Hardy's paradox tells us that retrodiction is very dangerous. That trying to figure out what was happening during the experiment based only on the final experimental results is a hazardous thing to do, and counterfactuals are also hazardous. That there's no such thing as really interaction-free measurement, And it's the possibility of interference in the apparatus that is part of the measurement context and will affect the results. The Bohmian perspective on this is that you have a non-local quantum potential, which causes some of the trajectories to be driven into the dark port, even though without this missing wave function part, they would have gone on to the bright port. So, conclusion of this part is that even the simplest, most reliable measurements can be wrong. And so realistic trajectories are related to various paradoxes, contextuality, and therefore also anomalous weak values.
So I think we better conclude.
All right, then I won't read this slide.
Good. Okay, let's thank the speaker. We have time for maybe one or two questions. Yes?
Have you published this? That was really interesting.
No, I have not.
Okay, Lev?
I think Bohm can defend himself. You said some unique classical detectors. Bohmian detectors which have Bohmian position recording, moving fast, will never show any kind of surrealistic trajectory. So you can be with Bohmian from the beginning to the end, everything will be consistent. And I'm opposed to you saying there is no interaction to the measure.
Okay, I think Holger, you wanted to ask a question?
Just something to confirm, because you were comparing the Bohmian detectors with different observables. But you actually don't have a definition at the same time of, for example, a momentum when you have a position in the Bohmian picture, right?
Yes, these are all positions. These are all what you would have called the position.
So they're physically completely different in any case, because you're not comparing the same thing.
Right. My point here is that you can reformulate your theory to have a different preferred variable.
Okay, but it's very different in terms of what they discussed.
Correct.
Okay, let's thank our speaker again.